Welcome to Soundwalker. This is your host, David Rothenberg. This is episode 17, Kathleen Dean Moore on Earth's Wild
One
Music.
One day, day of miracles and rejoicing, the spadefoot hears the grumble of thunder in an approaching storm and the peck, peck of rain on the sand.
I've been following the work of Kathleen Moore for many, many years because she's, like myself, a philosopher who's moved on to the world of nature writing and reflection on our deepest passionate and spiritual connections to the natural world. I was so excited to hear that her latest book is called Earth's Wild Music.
Wow.
And she brings in a musical approach, sound, actual sound, and the metaphor of sound in the beauty of making sense of our planet in this time where we're struggling so much to save it. How do we go beyond despair, go beyond grief, to love and celebrate this world? So Kathleen, I'm curious how you, as a philosopher, made this long journey to resonate with and inhabit and celebrate the Earth's wild music.
Are you a philosopher, David?
Officially, yes, that's my job. And I got into philosophy through environmental issues, working with Arne Næss in Norway on the environmental side. How did you go into it?
Let's see, that was in the 60s. That was in the time when tear gas was floating through campus, the University of Colorado. And when the analytic philosophers and the humanists were going at it, tearing out each other's throats, I was the first woman to have come on campus into the philosophy department since 1939, it was brutal. And I have to confess that I didn't have courses that I wanted to soak up. I didn't have professors who were fill me with ideas and encouragement. I resisted my education from the start. Tried to think of a different way, just like, as you were saying, isn't there a better way to write this stuff? Isn't there a more important thing to talk about? You know, how can you waste so much time on ideas that have so little effect?
So, but you were in it though. Like, were you already like antagonizing these characters in the 60s as a student?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote two dissertations. Both of them were a search for something that really mattered. And in the first dissertation I wrote, it was about rethinking water rights, rethinking how we assign water rights. I was told that that was not a philosophical subject, and I put it in the bottom drawer and never looked at it again. Switched over, went to law school for a little while and wrote a dissertation about the president's pardoning power. And when they tried to tell me that that was not a philosophical problem, I convinced them that it in fact was a deeply moral problem. So that was a success in my mind, to find a way to make philosophy count.
And did they have to accept that one eventually?
Well, they did, because Oxford University Press published it. For years, I taught philosophy of law, which I liked very much. But those were the years when the environmental crisis was steepening. Those were the years when it was not possible to ignore it. So I started teaching environmental ethics. And then I designed the course that was called Philosophy of Nature. It was a 10-day sojourn in the Oregon Cascades on the edge of a lake. I brought every little boat I owned, dumped them all in the water, and sent them out on the water with questions that had no answers. So it's the best fun I've ever had teaching.
So what were some of those questions that had no answers?
What is the natural world and how are we related to it? What is a human being? You know those questions. How then shall we live? The basic fundamental metaphysical questions.
Yeah, philosophy is always asking these impossible things. Was there a moment that you specifically said, I'm going to now write in a different way?
That was when I wrote that dissertation
on
philosophy of law, right. I intended that to be a book that people would read, that the pardon attorney would put on her desk. And in fact, it was. I was not going to waste my time with writing that nobody wanted to read from the very start. I had to make the case, of course, that that was philosophical writing because, as you know, the question everybody always asks in a philosophy department is, But is that philosophy?
Yeah, I'm always telling people, look, the way they're telling you to teach and think and write in graduate school outside here, it just doesn't work. You have to unlearn it very fast, because this is like this insular myth that you have to talk this way. Look at all these people, all these professors. They end up writing differently if they have any influence anywhere. Like, this game is for a little while, but then you just have to stop playing it and communicate some other way or another. Don't get too into this game that's going on here. One would hope eventually they would just encourage, like, dissertations to be readable, be more real and down to earth and not so technical. And I don't know, I'm not often advising PhD students in philosophy. I don't have any of my own. I advise people in other fields around the world all the time. It could be art or music or environmental studies or performance art, but never in philosophy, because I think that you know, there still is this technical sense. But I'm always celebrating the fact that philosophers are doing all this other stuff, and you better realize that.
And, you know, I had a pivotal moment in my writing life when a colleague came into my office and he said, what's your alternative life? If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing? And I said, well, I would be sitting on the edge of a pond and writing about the clouds, thinking of my hero, Henry David Thoreau. He came back a week later and he said, you know, I found two more people who had the exact same answer. We should form a writing group. And so we did. And he, a brilliant essayist, taught us all the form of the essay. And it was all uphill from there.
So there was a specific form he was teaching you, like the form of the essay. And did it work? What is the form of the essay?
The form of the essay is like the dive of an osprey, where you begin with hungry, careful, patient watching. And what you see are surfaces, the sun on the water, the sun on the tule reeds. And then something breaks open and you catch a glimpse of a shadow beneath the surface. And you fold your wings and you dive. And then you struggle and struggle and try everything you possibly know to bring that shadow up into the light. So that, I think, you know, people often say, you know, what's the form? What is the secret? And usually a writer will say, well, there is no predetermined. But I think in the case of an essay, there is. It's an experience and then an exploration of the meaning of that experience. Oftentimes up and down and up and down. And that's what makes it so exciting. That's why essays are they're so risk laden, because when you dive after something, you don't know if it's going to drown you or you're going to be able to get it out of the water. So that's why I love the form of the essay, because it is, you know, literally in the French essayé, it's to try. And so it's to take on a challenge with no certain outcome. I was, just reading in The Guardian, I was reading Rebecca Solnit, and she said, our work is to make the invisible visible. And I thought, yes, that's true, but our work also is to make the inaudible audible.
I think I came across that too and had the same, this thought, yeah. And she's such a prime example of somebody who writes beautifully and aesthetically and also so clearly about what we must do, that I think is, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges for me. And I think something you probably have some good ideas about, how we can still celebrate all this when we know how bad things are. We know that things are really just getting worse. We have to do something. Then what are we doing out there writing these essays, just experiencing this beauty? Are we not just, you know, off our minds, like out of touch by not doing something pragmatic? You know, I know so much of your work is about this, so you clearly have thought a lot.
Yeah, I think that it's very pragmatic to celebrate the earth, because the goal is to remind people of how much they love it, how much they love the music, and then to remind them what love means. Here's the philosopher speaking. You know, loving isn't a kind of la-di-da, as I've written. Loving is a sacred trust. If you love something, that means that you are devoted to it. You are convinced of its absolute worth, and you'll spend your life defending it. So yes, the first step, I think, in saving something is loving it. And if we can help people listen to the silence of extinction, which is so hard to hear, then I think we can remind them of what they love too much to lose.
How did you decide in this last book that music was going to be a theme that tied everything together?
I was surprised to discover that the essays that I had collecting in a pile on my desk were almost all about music. And I didn't do that intentionally. It's just that in my traipsing around in Alaska and in Oregon, that's what I apparently was paying attention to. So when I realized that I had been writing about music all these years, I decided to put together a book in celebration of the music as a stand-in for ongoing life. That's what natural music is, I think. It is the urgent expression of the urgency of ongoing life. Birdsong is love songs, right? So I thought, well, I can do two things at once. I can celebrate the songs of the natural world, and I can help people open their hearts to them so that I can call attention to their extinction without breaking their hearts. You see what I was trying to do? It's so hard to write about extinction. People turn away from it. It turns them to stone, just like Medusa. It's so ugly. But if you can convince them to pay attention long enough to rejoice, then I think that you can also help them understand the urgency of the struggle and the magnitude of the loss.
You said something in there. You said something, music stands for ongoing life, something like that. What did you mean by that?
I meant that music is the expression, the natural expression of the urgency of ongoing life. If you think about what birds are doing when they are singing, they are attracting a mate. They are singing the song of ongoing life. Come to me. Come to me and we will create new life. Frogs, come to me and we will create ongoing life. I presume water boatmen, come to me and we will create ongoing life.
So, okay, this idea like natural music is celebrating the creation of life. That's wonderful. And so all this singing is going back and forth and it's right around us. Like most things in nature, most people miss it, right?
Yeah, they miss it. And even when it's gone, they miss it. I mean, they don't miss it. Let me put that differently. People don't notice the absence of sound. Although in evolutionary terms, we are designed to hear the absence of sound as a signal for danger. And you've had that experience of walking through a forest and then suddenly everything goes silent. And you know there is a predator afoot.
Yeah, that's in the science of amphibian calls. There's a whole literature of the silence as a signal. When they stop, this means something. You want to go hear the frogs, you want to get close, and they all stop. That's telling everybody something. I thought it was interesting in your book, at the end of many chapters, you include one dark fact, sometimes in a box. Usually it's in a box. After the evocative, beautifully written, structured essay, then it ends with this box of some depressing thing. Like, oh, just when I was starting to get excited now, oh no, there's no insects anymore. And then this, you know, red-bellied sapsuckers down, you know, this kind of stuff. And then, oh, how did you end up doing that? What led you to use that structure, which is a little unusual, I think, compared to your previous books or other books of essays?
That was my solution. I hope it worked. To a problem of honesty. You can't just celebrate the natural world and not say anything about its decline. That is lying by omission. So at the same time, you can't drag people down. No one is motivated by despair. So I decided that what I would do is I would celebrate. I would talk about how glorious and how joyful the sounds of the world are. And then I would tell about the conservation status of the animal I had been extolling. How many are left? How many are expected to be left? So, for example, the meadowlark, which I think has one of the most beautiful calls in the universe. The meadowlark is losing its calls because in the meadows, the prairies where it lives, fracking is coming in with such an intensity of sound that the young meadowlarks can't hear their parents, and so they're having trouble learning the songs. And so as a result, their songs of the young ones are fragmented in the cacophony of the fracking fields. So the essay about meadowlarks is talking about how beautiful they are and how the prairie is beautiful and how we're losing that song. And then at the end, there's the box that says that 60% of the prairie birds, individual birds, are gone. Whereas we might have seen 10, now we only see 4. Whereas we might have heard 10, now we only hear 4, and their songs are broken. It's a kind of honesty that I think is required in a book of celebration.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the challenge. How much do you want to lift people up while at the same time saying, look, you still should be upset about this? And what would you have your readers do when they know that this is happening to the meadowlark song in the midst of these fracking fields? What would you have them do with that information? What would you like them to do with that?
That was another decision I had to make as a writer, is how stridently to call to them. So that is in the epilogue. And I think that there are 3 things we have to do. The first is to stop the destruction. No more rivers, no more forests, no more prairies can be destroyed. The second is to start restoring with every ounce of energy we have, start putting things back in place, start creating places of safety, refuges. President Biden's 30% is not enough. E.O. Wilson's 50%, maybe, to save wild places and to restore them, or to pre-store them, which is anticipating change to their vibrancy of life. And then the third is to start thinking in better ways about who we are in the earth and what we owe in terms of gratitude for the gifts that we've been given. So a total kind of metaphysical restructuring of who we are in the world and how we ought to live.
Yes, all those things should be done. I know I'm always wrestling with how positive to be and how strident, how emphatically telling people to do things. I'm always unsure where to come down the balance between what individual behaviors should change or how much we should lobby to change the structure of how society is dealing with these problems. I'm never sure how much to say about all these things, except just do everything.
Well, of course, we have to make changes in our personal lives and in our consumption. But that has been a red herring of the greatest magnitude, this notion that it's our fault because of the decisions that we make, and that if we would all just make better decisions as consumers, everything would be okay, not noticing that our decisions as consumers are constrained by what the fossil fuel industry and the plastics industry and the agriculture industry are doing to the world. And that what they would love for us to do is to focus on recycling rather than focus on restraining their actions, which are being carried out with almost no moral or legal restraint. So you've pushed one of my buttons, David, because I think that question about, is this a matter of personal responsibility or is this a matter of corporate wrongdoing? That question, I think, is answered. We've got business people sitting down behind their mahogany desk, shooting their cuffs and making decisions that are intentional and knowing or unforgivably reckless about business plans that will take down the living systems on the planet. How can that be right? How can that be tolerable? That's the other thing Rebecca Solnit says, is that another job that we have is to make the, let's see, what was it? Unacceptable, we have to make unacceptable what we have long considered to be acceptable.
You've probably heard of Michael Mann's recent book about this. I thought he was very hard hitting about this, saying it's not your fault. It's not that everyone has to, you know, recycle. Climate change is not caused by you. It's these corporate policies, and they're trying to. He goes back to the crying Indian. They've been trying to foist it off on you since that ad that I certainly remember so well from childhood. You know, like they've always been trying to make it in your fault when it's always been their fault, and they've been pushing this message, and that's just dishonest. And that they really have to change the things they have the power to change. And so we have to be so careful because there's such a difference between the messaging and what's actually being done, because it's so much easier to change the message than to change the whole system.
It is. I'm not sure that you're interested in this context, but my next book is called Bearing Witness, the Human Rights Case Against Fracking and Climate Change.
Sure.
Yeah. And it reports on a international human rights tribunal that doesn't mince any words. They said that the fracking industry, and in particular, fracking in particular, and the climate change that it's causing is a massive violation of human rights that is enabled by governments who are utterly failing in their responsibility to protect human rights. They call it an axis of betrayal. This is an example of the work to make what has long been acceptable unacceptable, to point out the costs.
Do you think that it's a useful way forward for environmental thinking to not have this division between doing things for nature as opposed for humans? Because that was always a big part of environmental philosophy as I studied it, that we have to think of the intrinsic value of nature, do things for nature, not for humans. But over time, it seems that maybe that was not the best way to go, because it's for humans, for human rights, for humanity as part of nature that we care about this stuff. If you just look in terms of nature, over millions of years, nature, doesn't care if we fail and mess everything up. It'll come back. We're not going to destroy all the systems of the planet, because nature thinks in eons and millions of years, that we're actually talking about humans together with nature. That must be why this human rights angle is proving fruitful for you.
I think it's a breakthrough. That notion of separating out environmentalism and social justice movements was disastrous. And that's one of the things that makes me hopeful, finally, is that people understand that you can't have social justice in the midst of environmental destruction. And you can't have environmental destruction without social injustice. And that every fracking well dug is a massive violation of people's rights to health and life, security. It's what the court called a huge, uncontrolled, large-scale experiment in poisoning human beings in absolute violation of the Nuremberg principles.
Which court said that and when?
The court is called the Permanent People's Tribunal. You'll be glad to know it's the court that was set up to try the United States for war crimes by two philosophers, Jean-Paul Sartre and Bertrand Russell.
Really?
It continues to this day as an independent human rights tribunal.
What's the best way to communicate these ideas? You're writing these beautifully written, accessible books in between literature and activism, and now you've even gotten into music. This whole organization producing music to go with the music of nature that you're doing. How did you end up going in that direction? How did that come to be, this organization? Name is suddenly escaping me.
The organization I work with is called the Spring Creek Project.
Right.
Ideas, Nature, and the Written Word. It's at Oregon State University. And we were thinking about this problem that writers face all the time, which is that in a situation this extreme, words are not enough. They just aren't. And so we turn to music and we turn to literature, the artistic expression, and decided to put them together. He frog kicks through loose sand to the surface, which is shiny again with ponds where females lurk, heavy with eggs. Will he swell with anticipation? His eyes bulge, it's true, but they always bulge. Will he tremble with thanksgiving? No, he sits exactly like a stone. And then he begins to sing. The words to his song, I am told, are gua, gua.
Here is flutist and composer Jane Rigler.
They asked me to record the sounds that might go along with this poem. And I recorded with the bass flute and also electronics. And I basically used my imagination. It was really about just this dreamy soundscape of my own imagination. And it's really nothing more than that. I mean, I didn't do a whole lot of research. I did listen a little bit, of course, to the Spadefoot Toad sound, but I wasn't thinking about emulating or trying to like be anything. I was just imagining. I was just being with my instrument. I really wanted it to be about a moment in time. What's it like to be now and in this moment? Just the imagination of sound.
Spotted sandpipers begin their perpetual peeping at first light. I pull warm piles of sleeping bag to my chin and lie there listening, glad to be awake again on such a morning. A Caspian tern sails across the lily pads, screeching with a voice so rough, I feel it could scrape off the top of my head. The calls of shorebirds, which evolved at the edge of the sea, have high frequencies, audible over the low rumble of surf. On the forest floor, birds have low frequency voices because the long wavelengths are not as quickly scattered by tangles of leaves and moss. But put a bird in an open meadow where sound can carry forever in the sunlit scent silence? Here are the voices so beautiful to the human, also a savanna creature.
That is poet Amy Nzuku Matatil reading Kathleen's text about the meadowlark, along with music by Jane Rigler.
You know, as much as anybody knows, that music carries emotion and ideas straight into the heart. And that's what we wanted to do, was bypass the bindings, bypass the printed page, and go straight to the heart. And that was our, as I said, that was our goal, was to open people's hearts without breaking them. And we thought that music is the one thing that can do this, because music heals even as it tears us apart. So I pulled from Earthwild Music, my book, I pulled a number of excerpts, and I asked a wonderful group of readers to read those excerpts. Robin Kimmerer, Jane Hirschfield, Craig Childs, Mosley Woda, Ishmael Hope. And we asked any number of extraordinary musicians to play behind them. So we have Jane Rigler on the flute, and we have Mark Weaver on the tuba. We have wonderful percussionists. And then I sat down and I wove them together. And those films were produced. We call them tiny concerts because each one is only 4 minutes long. Each one is a very short musical and spoken word tribute to one animal, the spadefoot toad, the humpback whale, the albatross, the meadowlark, the spotted croaker, the black spotted croaker. Understanding that you don't have to go on and on and on to reach people. And sometimes a really short, emphatic composition will do that job.
Yeah, it's a beautiful idea and very innovative and wonderful to ask other writers to read your words, see what they do with them and bring other people in.
Absolutely. That has been the greatest joy, to hear people read so beautifully, so much more beautifully than I ever could, and bring the words that I have written on the page to life in the real world. That is such a gift that they've given. You know, when I write, I don't cry. I can write the saddest sentences. I can talk about sorrow as a sacred space. I can distinguish between grief and despair and invite people to welcome grief, and I never cry. But when I hear someone else read my work and when music is carrying those words, I just sit and weep. So there is real power in art. I think about Medusa a lot because the circumstances of the world are so horrifying that when we look at them directly, we turn to stone, just as people could not bear the countenance of Medusa. And it's a real problem because we are paralyzed in the face of a danger that is unlike any other. But what Theseus did with his winged sandals and his magic sword and his reflective shield was turn the shield so that it reflected Medusa. And he could see her refracted. He could see her with a slightly different image. He could actually manage to see her without being paralyzed. And then, of course, he reached out his sword and cut off her head. And I think that art is our reflective shield that allows us to see without being destroyed by what we see. And it allows us then to take action that we have to take. So a musician or a writer has as her work to represent the truth and to represent it in such a way that it can be perceived or heard. And that's why I'm very excited about music, because music is one of the things that we welcome with open hearts. So if we can attach our ideas to the music, or let music carry the ideas and the images into the mind, then I think we will be empowered against these forces that would paralyze us.
So how did you feel being a writer and philosopher and someone used to spending lots of time out in the wilderness when you went on the road performing with this pianist and this piece?
When I first turned towards nature writing, I said to myself, you know, this is going to really be great. Because if you're a nature writer, people are going to take you to the most extraordinary and special places. And that has turned out to be true. So I know that every time I go to give a talk at some college, the students will trundle me out into their magical places. And that has been the great gift of this work, is to be in special places in the presence of people who love them, and to be invited into these extraordinary places that you would never find, to be invited to experiences, to be invited to go out with hydrophones and listen to whales, or to be invited to walk through a snowy night to count the little cries of the wolf pups, or, you know, all the things that I've been invited to do as a result of being a writer, being invited to walk with Gordon Hempton to the 1 square inch of silence in the Olympic National Forest on a day of thunderous rain. It's the greatest joy.
And then when you got there, did everything suddenly get quiet? Like the rain, the clouds parted, the sun came down to the 1 square inch, and it was all quiet in this natural way that quiet is supposed to be. Did you have that experience? I'm always recommending to people his book that he published himself about how to record nature, called Earth is a Solar Powered Jukebox, only available on his website.
Because
that's very interesting.
I imagine that, you know, he wanted to do this book. His publishers were saying, we're not doing this. Like, you know, this is not what people care about. Okay, I'll just do it my way, myself, because I know. Like, and you know, he's right. This is his vision. He has to do it this way. And there it is.
Yes, and I love his work about the dawn chorus too, recording, going all around the world as the sun, and as the sun rose, recording the sounds of the birds that are awakening. And that's become a really important image in my life, this notion that as the earth turns, the music plays. And it is, I wouldn't call it a jukebox, I call it a music box, except instead of the little metal prongs playing the music, it's the rays of the sun.
Mm.
And I think about if aliens from other planets would look at the Earth, they would probably not so much notice that it's the watery planet or that it's the blue planet. They would think of it, I think, as the singing planet. how extraordinary that is.
The Singing Planet. Yeah, who's used that title? Maybe that one is still up out there. We could. that's a good one. The Singing Planet.
And then I've heard that not only is there a dawn chorus of birds, there's also a dawn chorus of reef fishes. That also, as the sun rises over the reefs, the fish start to sing and baa and coo and click and clap. And then it occurs to me also that there's a dawn chorus of activists. That as the earth turns, people are getting up out of their bed and or off of their mats, and they're making a cup of coffee or a cup of atole, and they are going out to do the work of saving the music of the world. And it's an image that thrills me, knowing that none of us is alone, that we're all of us part of this great chorus of affirmation.
Yeah, that was one of the most memorable things that you said at your book launch event, when someone asked a question of, what do I do once I realize all of this that I should be in such despair about? And you said, find somebody else who also cares and go out there and do something together. And I thought, that's really a good answer.
That question comes all the time. What can one person do? And my answer always is, stop being one person. Find your chorus. Find your cause. Find your community of caring. And then the work becomes joyous.
Absolutely. I think I've found in my efforts making music with nature, you know, over recent years, I've tried to bring as many other people together with me as possible, instead of the story of one person alone on this quest. Like it's much more interesting to see how others bring their own approaches into this tale, and it becomes much richer, more surprising, and, you know, it goes in directions you never would expect. And so I think I certainly sense that in your work with the Spring Creek Project and this music, and like, I had no idea. I knew that you were a philosopher and also doing nature writing, but now there's this musical side, and not just the metaphor of music and the earth, but actually making music with all kinds of people and pushing this connection in many different simultaneous ways. I was really so happy to discover that and say, look, all this is really something interesting here. So I hope as many people as possible find out what's, you know, so special about what you're doing, and that they learn about it and read the book, watch these videos, and hear the music around, and the balance between celebration and concern that you're really, you know, putting together.
The films are all up. The tiny concerts are all up on YouTube. You just go to YouTube and then go to the Spring Creek Project and then go to Music to Save Earth Songs, and they're all right there at the playlist. One of the questions that you sent to me was, how do you rise out of despair? And the point that I would make about that is that it's important to make a distinction between grief and despair. I will not allow myself to fall into despair, but I invite myself to be embraced by grief. And the difference, I think, is this, that grief is the understanding that the world is full of meaning and beauty, and we're losing it, and it is being denied to us. But despair is the notion, the feeling, the conviction that the earth has lost all meaning. So whether it's taken from us or not doesn't matter. It has no value. So I think of grief as an affirmation of our love to the world. A grief is a measure of our loving. And so invite it in. Let it hold you. Let it stroke your hair. Despair, which is the denial of all meaning and all love, is dangerous. It's our worst enemy, and we should never allow it in the front door.
Sometimes I think that in philosophy and in cultural studies of all kinds, there's too much of the sense that we're constantly told people are making all the meaning. So it's all our fault again, rather than this notion that the earth has meaning is something that so many people are afraid to say.
That's what the job of an essayist is. That's, I think, among many other people. An essayist, to live a life as an essayist, is to live with the constant conviction that there is meaning in our experience, and to be looking for it. So that's often a search for the perfect metaphor. What is the meaning? What is the meaning of a water boatman that clicks around in the water? What does that mean for us? And that's maybe an act of faith, but it's also an act of creation, and it's also an act of listening, which is why the music is so important. The world is talking to us if we could only hear its cries.
Yes, I think, and you, when you mentioned the dawn chorus, you know, it's interesting how the science of bird song is starting to change about the dawn chorus just in recent years, because previously it was just seen as like too confusing to make sense of. Like, everyone's doing all this stuff at once, let's just try and find one bird and study a song. But now it's becoming clear that the interaction between all the sounds is of deep importance, and that clearly these species listen to each other, something that was never admitted by biologists until recently, that one bird species is listening to other ones all the time. The things that naturalists notice all the time, like, why are these starlings talking to the house sparrows? They actually are all the time. And that this could be very significant for figuring out the whole music of the world from dawn to dusk and everything in between.
And even as we're only just beginning to understand it, only just beginning to listen carefully, it's being taken from us by captains of industry. And that Gordon Hempton, who initially recorded that dawn chorus, told me not long ago that he couldn't do that anymore because the songs have so much been silenced.
But that quickly can get to despair, you know, rather than grief, like, oh my God, all this has been taken down by the pioneers, and now we can't hear it anymore. The silent spring, you know, the great animal orchestra disappearing, you know, what do we do? It can easily get to despair. I think you're right to say, stick to grief. Grief is something very different. You know, that's, I think that's actually a good way that being a philosopher can be helpful. Sometimes distinguishing these terms doesn't mean taking all the emotion away. I think you've helped me realize that.
Yes, and take our anguish and shape it into something that's fierce enough to stand in defense of what you might lose otherwise. So there is a use, I think, to grief if we can turn it, if we can understand it as an expression of love, and if we can understand love as an expression of the determination to defend, then I think grief is going to be a friend of the earth in this struggle.
So do you think this emphasis on love and music can help fight against the tendency towards burnout that so many people feel, caring too much about things they feel powerless to change?
Yes, and my new book that I'm working on now is called Take Heart, Encouragement for Earth's Weary Lovers, which is a set of 21 affirmations that try to do exactly that. The point, though, that I would make is that our biggest ally in our work to defend the natural world is the natural world. That the kind of strength and joy that we get from being outside sends us back into the struggle. So that even as we are getting weary, the earth is doing everything it can to buck us up. It's giving us music. It's sending us out marching to the sound, to the sounds of water boatmen. It's providing us the courage and the strength and the stubbornness to keep going, because it's giving us these great gifts. What a more marvelous ally in the struggle could we have than the earth's wild music? And if it's not out there singing to us, we have to ask why.
Kathleen Dean Moore, thank you so much for joining us. Talking about your book, Earth's Wild Music, we heard excerpts from some of the animal interludes where Kathleen has asked other writers and musicians to present bits of her work. We heard contributions by Jane Rigler and a reading by Amy Nizuku Matatil. You can hear more of these beautiful, poetic, musical animal interludes on the website of the Spring Creek Project at Oregon State University. We conclude with some music called Oscillation by Jane Rigler and Janet Fetter. David Rothenberg for Soundwalker. See and hear you next time.